The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I work in the author events office here, and I am very honored to be here this evening to introduce Gary Steingart. The satire of Nikolai Gogol meets the painfully self-aware pop cultural references of Richard Linklater, meets the hilarity of Judd Apatow, meets the intense autobiography of Philip Roth in the absurdity, detail, and personal obsessions of Gary Steingart's novels. Replete with psychotic war heroes, scheming expats, and a fun-loving but homicidal gangster named Hedgehog, his 2002 debut, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, won the Stephen Crane Award for First Fiction. He followed up this success with Absurdistan, praised as, quote, an immodestly vigorous novel about cross-cultural love, the disillusionment of sudden democracy, and the crony capitalism of Halliburton, experienced through the eyes of the corpulent scion of the 1,238th richest man in Russia. In Super Sad True Love Story, a novel packed with what Time magazine referred to as satirical gunpowder, Mr. Steingart imagines a dystopic vision of an oversexed, consumer-obsessed, gadget-distracted, and dangerously superficial America. Mr. Steingart is also noted as a prolific writer of blurbs. One such blurb is in tonight's program, but I'm going to give you one more nugget. Quote, "Suck it, Proust. This book about stuff is much better than those things you wrote." End quote. This blurbing has inspired a Tumblr anthology, a live reading, and a short documentary film about which Steingart himself, in a layer upon layer down the rabbit hole metacriticism, claims combines the hard-won wisdom of Hoop Dreams with the epic scope of Ken Burns' Civil War thingy. I only hope that we can continue the meta-ness of all this by asking Mr. Steingart to blurb this blurb about his blurbs. The ridiculously witty and painfully prescient Steingart returns with Little Failure, a tender, self-deprecating, rollicking memoir of his experiences in the contradictory worlds of uber-consumerist America and the perpetually deprived Soviet Union of his youth. Born in Leningrad, his family moved to New York in the 1970s, and from this space between two worlds, he gives us this affectionate but unflinching look at his past. A New York Times review calls Little Failure a testament to Mr. Steingart's abilities to write both self-mocking humor and introspective wisdom, sharp-edged sarcasm and aching, and yes, Chekhovian tenderness. This book has also been referred to as Nabokovian, and I assure you that with a bit of internet research, you'll find several other glowing reviews peppered with adjectives based on the names of famous dead Russian writers. Tonight, Mr. Steingart will be discussing this memoir and his other work with Daniel Tordai. Mr. Tordai is a visiting professor of creative writing at Bryn Mawr College and the author of the National Jewish Book Award-winning novella, The Sensualist. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please all join me in welcoming Gary Steingart and Daniel Tordai to the stage.
It's great to be here. I can't believe they canceled my first reading because of the snow. It was so heartbreaking. I was just lying there in my hotel crying. The best thing about this book is clearly the cover. Right? This is me in the Soviet Union. They had these photo studios where they posed you with the latest in Soviet technology. Like a phone, you know, and this one is a car. Even then, you could tell I'm scared of the wheel, and I'm just sitting there like a little hamster. And only this year, at age 41, did I learn how to drive. So, look out, Philadelphia. Seriously, look out. I'm a terrible driver. So I'll read a little passage. This is right after we emigrated to the United States from the Soviet Union. And so I came, we were only Russian speakers, and I had to learn English and some Hebrew because I was sentenced to 8 years of Hebrew school for a crime I did not commit. But, there it was. In 1980 was a difficult time to be a Russian in America. You know, remember Ronald Reagan's Evil Empire speech and all those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, you know. So I pretended to the kids in Hebrew school that I was actually born in East Berlin, not in Russia. You know things are bad when you're trying to convince Jewish kids that you're actually a German. So. But because I was the red gerbil, the second most hated kid in Hebrew school, I thought, what if I wrote a science fiction novel, I love science fiction, and showed it to the kids in school? Maybe they'll learn to like me. And one of these novels actually survives. Oh, right? Yeah, sad. Written on these giant, and look how much crap there is. It's unbelievable. Pages after pages. Let's open it up and see what's inside. Chapter 1, Something is Wrong. And was there ever. And then when I'm about 11 years old, something great happens, a momentous thing. A substitute teacher named Ms. S. comes to my Hebrew school, and this is what transpires. On one of the first days on the job, Ms. S. asks us all to bring in our favorite items in the world and to explain why they make us who we are. I bring in my latest toy, a dysfunctional Apollo rocket whose capsule pops off with the press of a lever, but only under certain atmospheric conditions. Humidity must be below 54%, and explain that I've even written my own novel. This passes largely unremarked as the latest batch of Star Wars X-Wing fighters and My Little Ponies are paraded around. Finally, Miss S. holds up a sneaker and explains that her favorite activity in the world is jogging. P.U., a boy cries out, pointing at the sneaker and holding his nose, and everyone except me laughs their wicked child laugh. I am shocked. Here is a young, kind, pretty teacher, and the children are intimating that her feet smell. Only me and my 200-pound Leningrad fur coat are allowed to smell around here. I look to Miss S., so worried she will cry, but instead she laughs and then goes on about how running makes her feel good. After we have all finished explaining who we are, Miss S. calls me over to her desk. You really wrote a novel? She asks. Yes, I say. It is called The Challenge. May I read it? Yes, you may read it. I will brink it. And brink it I do. With the worried admonition, please don't lose Miss S., okay? And then it happens. At the end of the English period, when a book about a mouse who has learned how to fly in an airplane has been thoroughly dissected, Miss S. announces, and now Gary will read from his novel. His what? But it doesn't matter, because I'm standing there holding my composition notebook straight from the Square Deal notebook people of Dayton, Ohio, zip code 45463. And looking out at me are the boys beneath their little flying saucer yarmulkes and the girls with their sweet aromatic bangs, their blouses studded with stars. And there's Miss S., who I'm already terribly in love with, but who I've recently learned has a fiancé. Not sure what that means. Can't be good. But whose bright American face is not just encouraging me, but priding me on. Am I scared? No, I'm eager. Eager to begin my life. Introduction, I say. The mysterious race. Before the age of dinosaurs, there was human life on Earth. They looked just like the man of today, but they were a lot more intelligent than the man of today. Slowly, Miss S. says. Read slowly, Gary. Let us enjoy the words. I breathe that in. Miss S. wants to enjoy my words. And so I continue slower. They built all kinds of spaceships and other wonders, but at that time, the Earth circled the Moon because the Moon was bigger than the Earth. One day, a gigantic comet came and blew up the Moon to the size it is today. As I'm reading this, despite the misspellings, I'm hearing a different language come out of my mouth. I do justice to the many errors, the Earth circled the Moon, and the Russian accent is still thick, but I am speaking in what is more or less comprehensible English. And as I am speaking, along with my strange new English voice, I am also hearing something entirely foreign to the squealing and shouting that constitutes the background noise of my Hebrew school. Silence. The children are silent. They are listening to my every word, and they will listen to the story for the next 5 weeks as well, because Miss S. will designate the end of every English period as Gary novel time. and they will shout out throughout the English period, "When will Gabby read already?" The school is close to Long Island. And I will sit there in my chair, oblivious to all but Miss S's smile, excused from following the discussion of the mouse who learned how to fly, so that I may go over the words I will soon read to my adoring audience. And God bless these kids for giving me a chance. May their God bless them, everyone.
Well, thank you very much for that, Gary. So I actually wanted to start off with just the sort of the large genre question, which is that you've published three novels, all of which I have loved, and I would assume many of us have loved as well. And I wonder...
USA.
However you've construed it, either through working on it or now that you're looking back on it, what have been the differences of working on fiction and now turning to memoir?
Well, you know, with a memoir, things are easier in one way and harder in a different way. Easier because I know the plot of this story. I know how it ends. Right now it ends with me here in Philadelphia. So there's no question about designing a plot. And, you know, literary writers often complain about plot. You know, I can't remember which writer said that plot is a terrible embarrassment. We're better at sort of, you know, going on about stuff and digressions. And, you know, if you grew up reading Saul Bellow's Herzog, I mean, what happens in that book? I don't know, but it's pretty amazing nonetheless.
He works on his house.
Yeah, you're right. And he has a sandwich on page 230, I think. But other than that, nothing really happens. But, of course, contemporary readers expect more plot than sandwich. But the scary thing about this for me is that, you know, it was, my three books are satires, but here I had to, I couldn't hide behind humor all the time because some of this stuff isn't that funny, you know. The parts about Hitler and Stalin weren't exactly hilarious. So it was a question of modulating my voice and making sure that, you know, I didn't lead with the humor the way I did in the satirical works.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, that was a question I was going to ask later, but because you set it up, the phrase you used was hide behind the humor, and you're such a funny writer. And I was struck from, you know, the first 10 pages of this book how much, you know, the humor would come in, but then the pathos would come in, and they were constantly switching spaces. Is that a conscious thing as you're working? How do you deal with that page to page?
Well, after a while, you get the voice down, and you sort of get, you know, the way when you're cooking, 20 minutes into the cooking, you're figuring out all the ingredients and how they interact. So it's similar to that, but it's tough, you know. It's tough because I have a Pavlovian response to humor. I just raise myself up on my hind legs, and my paws go up, and, you know, my tail starts wagging. This is the stuff I love, and I grew up reading and writing funny stuff, and that's you know, when I was 11 or 12 in Hebrew school, I wrote a satire of the Torah called the Gnora, you know, and where Exodus became Sexodus, you know, and stuff like that. And the progenitor of the Jewish people was Brooke Shieldowitz. if only that was the case. So that's always been where my humor has led. But here I realized that to do full justice to my family, which have been the victims of every horrible thing that the 20th century ever had to offer, from Hitlerism to socialism to, you know, certain other things, I had to hold back on the humor.
Can you describe how that felt? Did you know when you were writing those sentences that that's what you were doing?
Consciously, no. Because, again, it's when you discover the, you know, it's like tuning a piano. For each song, for each thing you play, you figure out, you know, the tuning, and then you just go on for 350 pages or until your editor says, please stop, just please stop.
Right. I'm going to take a brief interlude to mention that I'm going to ask Gary a series of questions, and then I'll turn it over to you guys. So I'm going to try not to steal all of your questions. On that same vein, you talk about Nabokov's Speak Memory as a kind of touchstone in the book, and Mary Carr blurb the book. Mm. Did you consciously look at memoirs and before thinking about it, and which were they?
You know, memoirs among literary writers are a little bit of a dirty word. It's very hard to walk around Brooklyn saying I'm writing a memoir, you know. I live in Manhattan, so huge load off my back there and my front. But I didn't talk about it very openly because, you know, people just say, oh, trying to cash in, are you? You know, ka-ching. For me, reading Mary Carr's Liar's Club, Nabokov's Speak Memory, Angela's Ashes, which was written by Frank McCourt, who was a teacher at Stuyvesant, but he left Stuyvesant right before I checked in there, which was horrible. But now I live in the building where he actually lived for most of his life in Manhattan. Although, as the co-op board said, and then he got rich and moved the hell out, you know, to Connecticut, I think. So anyway, there's been in reading these memoirs, I discovered that I really love this form. It doesn't have to be this sort of annoying fake confessional form. It can be something really beautiful. And when I read a lot of fiction these days, it feels so, the membrane between fact and fiction is so small a lot of the time that it shocks me. You know, when I was writing this, I thought, why make this fiction? I mean, what would be gained by it? Other than not getting sued by some people.
Right.
And the Solomon Schechter School of Queens.
Right. Who you're now being sued by.
No. Actually, they were very sweet. And one of my best friends, who's mentioned in this book, his wife is a Russian immigrant, and she now works in Schechter trying to acculturate Russian kids. This is exactly what I needed when I showed up there. You know, it was just somebody to acculturate me real good.
Mm-hmm. So as I was reading the memoir, I had this kind of wonderful familiarity sense, because there were many pieces that I knew I had read as they came out in The New Yorker and as they come out in The Times Magazine, and then I flipped to the back where, you know, every chapter felt like, oh, right, this has all been published a lot. Yeah. Were you setting out pieces and having them come out as you were working? Did you have a final manuscript? What was the composition process?
Well, in the end, a lot of stuff was used in other magazines, but it's often just a paragraph or a sentence. So I actually, in the end, did a computation, because I did go to Stuyvesant High School. The nerd in me had to know. And I figured out that 83% of this is new, and 17% has been used previously. When I wrote these articles, and a lot of it was for The New Yorker, I was just doing stuff for The New Yorker. So they would call me up and say, can you write something on traveling to Florida or whatever? So I'd write a piece about that. So when I started writing this memoir, I thought, okay, so I covered a lot of my life. If it's good, I'll use it. But a lot of the stuff that felt more difficult to write about was missing, simply because I didn't feel like putting it into a tiny, you know, GQ article or whatever. It required something bigger. And in connecting all these little things that appeared in previous magazines, I think I hit upon stuff that was a lot more difficult to write than the original articles. And that, I think, is the bulk of the book.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to make a huge right turn and ask you about book trailers. Are you all aware of book trailers? Have you seen Gary Steingart's book trailer with James Franco in it? If you haven't seen it, you should see it. But can we talk about it? How did it come together?
Yes. The book trailer begins with me, with the beautiful Rashida Jones coming up with the name Little Failure for my book, because she says, you're small in stature and you're a failure. that breaks my heart. She plays an editor at Random House. So I come crying to my husband, James Franco. There's a makeout scene, which is very hot. He has such moist lips, you know. And I don't. I have chapped lips. So I was very scared during the kissing scene. And it comes out that, it turns out that he has written a memoir too. It's a celebration of our erotic journey called 50 Shades of Gary. I'm very upset by this, and I storm off to see my psychiatrist, who is Jonathan Franzen. And he looks at my book and says, little failure, little narcissist is more like it. You know? And it just goes downhill from there. Anyway, it's on YouTube, so please watch it. How did it come together? Well, other than certain pockets of Philadelphia, nobody really wants to read books anymore. You have to make a movie about your book first before you can actually sell it. So, and you have to have stars like Rashida Jones and James Franco, and Alex Karpovsky from Girls is in it too. Oh, he's good. He sells me a $13 cup of coffee in Brooklyn.
Did you feel sad you didn't get to kiss him?
Huh?
Did you feel sad you didn't get to kiss him?
He looks, because he's a fellow Russian emigre, it'd be like making out with myself, you know. But a taller version. Whereas Franco has a Northern California kind of look, which I admire.
I'll just let that sit for a second.
just think about that in your own time.
We were talking back in the greenish room about your first book won the National Jewish Book Award, and I always wonder, like, what is the sense of identity? And like, did you think before that, oh, I'm a national Jew, or I'm a Jewish writer, or what's your sense of how that plays into your identity as a writer?
Well, Philip Roth always said, you know, I'm not a Jewish writer, I'm an American writer. But if being Jewish pays the bills, I'm a Jewish writer all the way. I'm an Ashkenazi writer. I'm whatever you have, I'll be it. You know, a Moorish writer, Sephardic. So I don't care. But it's strange. And when I was actually living in Italy at the time, I think I told you, and I was staying at this artist colony, and somebody had scribbled on a piece of paper and slipped under my door, "You've won the National Book Award." And I thought, oh my God. And then email was just sporadically used back then, and then I figured out that there were Jewish appeared in there somewhere. Which was fine. I was very happy, but much less so. But we are both fellow National Jewish Book Award winners. So.
Yes, and I.
How rare for a stage to accommodate so much national Jewry.
We are the two.
We are. We've been chosen for this.
Before we lose technology, I have a couple of technological questions I want to ask, and one corresponds to Google Glass.
Sure.
I assume you all know what Google Glass is, which is glasses where horrible things happen. And and Gary wrote this fantastic New Yorker piece about being an early adopter of Google Glass. After stepping away from that, how do you feel about the experience?
Well, it confirmed that I am scared of technology, and the technology has ruined a lot of my life. It's taken away my concentration. I used to read a book every week. Now it's a book every year. I exaggerate, but only so much. Actually, I think I used to read two. Yeah, it's just this. I read my own books. You know, it's hard. I when I was writing Super Sad True Love Story, which is set in a dystopian future, that's when I had to find out about technology, and I had an intern, a very attractive man that my friends called the Mantern. and the Mantern taught me about technology, and we got my first iTelephone. We learned about Facebooking and things like this. And slowly my life sort of left my, you know, I was no longer in charge of it. I was twittering like an idiot instead of writing. I realized that if I put up a picture of my dachshund, I will get more instant love than all these books combined. Luckily, I spend half the year in upstate New York, and AT&T is not a company that has technology that can reach, you know, beyond the Acela corridor. So when I go upstate, often I can't connect, and that's when I go back to having a life of the mind. Thank you, AT&T.
I think of you as being one of the better Twitterers, if you're willing to accept that epithet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what good you think it does for you and what's enjoyable about
Well,
it?
Well, I learn a lot. Today, I was tweeting about coming here, and I looked out of my hotel room, and my tweet was, "Oh, my God, I can't believe Philadelphia has a river." To which a million people instantly wrote, "There are two." So I started saying, "You should all take your houseboats or swim up to the free library," and promising free mooring at the free library. Then the Pittsburghians began to respond by saying, "Well, we have three." And another person actually has a theory that there are four. So I started saying, "What is Pennsylvania basically water world?" You know? That got a few retweets. So anyway, today I've learned a lot about the topography of your state. And
now I have too.
Yeah. So that's what it's used for.
There's a fair amount that goes on in this memoir of thinking about your development as a writer, and we learned that you read Isaac Asimov's science fiction
yes.
earlier on, and Super Sad True Love Story has elements of that as well.
Yes.
How do you think of genre? Do you think of genre? Does it matter?
Well, if it's good, it's good. Again, this goes back to how it's more about the way literary fiction has positioned itself as this little island of, you know, unreadable stuff in the middle of stuff people want to read. My goal in life has been to bring, to make this fun again. This is why I do these stupid trailers, because reading should be entertaining. I mean, this is something that sort of slipped away from people's grasp after a while because it became serious and there was a kind of academic undertone because so much of writing takes place in Master of Fine Arts programs. And I'm as guilty as anyone. I teach at Columbia. You teach at Bryn Mawr, not in an MFA, but in a writing program. We all teach, basically, in these institutions. But there's something that I feel, I mean, when I was growing up, I just wanted to read books, not because, you know, I was learning things, but because they were hilarious and interesting. In Russia, I started reading, or when I came to America, I didn't speak English, so I read in Russian a wonderful book called Gekelberry Finn. and I loved Gekelberry and his more bourgeois cousin, Tom Sawyer. I also fell in love with Becky Thatcher. And the Mississippi meant quite a bit to me, even though it was very far away, you know. But it was enjoyable. Each page was a page turner, and I thought, you know, if you're going to write, why make this hard on people? Sure, you have a story to tell, and sure, there are things that, as I mentioned about this book, where you have to step back from the purely humorous and the satiric and the, you know, the sort of the full on Dolby sound stereo entertainment, but if you don't want to, if you don't make people laugh and feel something, then what's the point of doing this? And that's where I want fiction to sort of remember that and to return to it. Because so many, you know, people work so hard these days. We're all, because of our eye telephone, we're wired into 24/7, we're doing something. If you're a white-collar worker, your entire day is basically just moving pieces of text around. And then you come home, and the last thing you're going to do is pick up a 350-page book and read. You'll turn on TV and watch True Detective or Girls or The Sopranos or whatever's on, because that has the narrative that we seek. We're always going to look for narrative. We love stories, but you're going to look for it in a way that's more passive because you're exhausted. You're exhausted from looking at words. And I love some of these shows. And in fact, super sad they're trying to make it into a TV series and I'm co-writing the pilot. Yeah, that'll be interesting, right? Paul Giamatti is Lenny and James Franco is Joshy. But the what interests me is, you know, how do we keep, especially for younger people, how do we keep this going? You know, I'm okay with Kindles. People always bring me Kindles to sign. I'll sign your Kindle. That's cool. Somebody already came up to me today and said, sign my Kindle. I said, I will. But something happens when it's on a Kindle, which is that it becomes just another text file that's being flung around into space. I'm not saying you shouldn't read it because these books are heavy. You're going on a trip. You know, yeah, download it. But this is actually a fascinating piece of technology because once you open it up and there's nothing else going on, it's almost like you're in a kind of mind melt of Star Trek proportions with another person. You're entering someone else's consciousness for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours, however long it takes you to read it. And whether you like the character or not, for a while you become, you know, a Pakistani cab driver in London or whoever it is that you're reading. To me, that's technology. That's, I mean, this is old stuff, 500 years old, but it's really amazing.
Yeah, so, and on that point, I recently finished a big piece about the influence of TV on just myself as a fiction writer, which I think is mostly good. But I wanted to reference this book by Brett Martin called Difficult Men, which is this great book that came out this summer about The Wire and The Sopranos. And when I wanted to quote from it in the piece, I had to go back to the book. I couldn't use the Kindle version. I had to go to the library because I just couldn't leaf. And I wonder, like, is that because I grew up that way or is it because it's an inferior technology for that function?
I think it's good to leave. I'm fine with people writing on books. But what happens is now that Kindle crowdsources which sentences of yours work and not. So things that you can underline things in Kindle. And there are focus groups that can also tell you which parts of your book need to go. So
that's the plan.
Imagine like Charles Dickens getting 40 UPenn graduates together and being like, "So what works, guys?"
You know. You really want to call him Ishmael?
Yeah, like, yeah. Call me Jerry. You know, would have been how it starts.
thinking about the beginning of this book, my father grew up in Budapest and then came to New York,
sure.
And I've spent a lot of time in my life thinking about what that experience was for him, and he speaks with kind of a diplomat's accent now, and he read your book, and he called me, and he said, that's the best I've ever seen somebody capture the experience of going from speaking in their native language to English. So do you like my father?
So I will blurb your father, possibly the best Hungarian father to immigrate in blank year.
Yeah. It's recorded on the podcast.
Yeah, you can use that blurb for whatever purposes he needs.
Can you talk a little bit about just what the experience was of trying to plumb that memory? Obviously, I mean, the data is just what's in your head. I mean, how consciously did you go through it? How did you make that happen?
It was really tough, you know, because my parents only spoke Russian in the home. We weren't allowed a TV in the home. And now I'm thankful that they did that because that's why I grew up having a brain. But, you know, at the time, the lingua franca of Hebrew school was the A-Team and Knight Rider and all those shows, talking cars, talking mules, whatever. But once you crossed the threshold to our house, it was, you know, Chekhov's Lady with Lapdog 24/7. So, and Russian. And my parents didn't learn English well because we only spoke Russian, but I retained Russian and the ability to read Lady with Lapdog in the original. And so for me, the switch to English was hard because my mind was, I mean, even 2 years into being in America, and most kids at age 7 just snap right to it, you know. But even 2 years after, I remember writing I had to do a book report on the Colosseum in Rome, and it was, had roof, not anymore, was how I describe that famous structure. And that's why it took me a long time until I was about 14 to lose the accent. And so I would practice in front of the mirror. We got a garden apartment with an attic, which was a big deal because we finally had an attic. The kids had, you know, 12-bedroom houses in Great Neck, but we had an attic. So I would keep practicing, we have an addict. And it came out as addict all the time, you know. So even getting addict to sound like addict took months, but it was a long journey. But it's interesting.
But did you feel like you discovered things as you were going back through the memory of it, putting it on a page?
Well, I discovered things a lot. I mean, a lot of stuff. Each morning I would wake up and writing this book, and I would say, okay, I'm 9 years old. What are my problems today? My parents are fighting. How do I save up 60 cents to buy the Carvel cookie ice cream that everyone so desires, that's, you know, in Hebrew school. Are the rabbis going to burst into the toilet where I'm eating my Russian salami and accuse me of starting the Holocaust, which one of them did, you know?
Was that true? Is that true?
Yeah. I was like, I did it.
Now you're Catholic.
Yes. So that was the level of, you know, just being scared of all these different things that you don't know how to navigate. Parents, school, trying to make a friend in a language that you don't really know, you know. That's, I think, the hardest thing is, and I was so shy, so terribly shy, that I had to become this clownish persona in order to overcome the shyness and write these things like the Gonora. And that's, I think, what led me to my first friend. There's a whole chapter called Jonathan, which is just about the first friend I ever made, who's now still a very good friend of mine, without whom I don't think I could have survived with my sanity or any kind of dignity intact.
So. I'm going to ask just a couple more questions, then I'm assuming you guys have got a bunch. We mentioned Mary Carr's Liars Club early on.
Yeah,
and
great book.
Mary was one of my students, and she... One of my students, yes. I'm very old. One of my teachers. Yeah, I was getting like, an MFA.
Wow.
I look
good,
right?
So well.
And she, in her memoir class, would sort of always tell this joke that she gave the manuscript of Liars Club to the people that were in it before it came out. And
yeah,
some people said they'd like to be redacted. And then when the book came out, the only people who called to complain said, you know, why wasn't I in your book?
Right.
What has been your experience so far of the people who you've put in the book and how they've felt about reading it?
Well, the big people are my parents. They usually wait for the Russian edition of stuff to come out. And thankfully, there isn't one yet. So, I think most people have been, well, the ones who emailed me have been very positive about it, but they're the ones that are portrayed with great love. Jonathan, my college roommate, who's from Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh makes a tiny appearance in there.
It has like 12 rivers.
Yeah. We go to see the Pittsburgh Pears play a game or whatever they're called. But I don't know. You know, when you write, you can't think of what the reaction will be, even to the people you love, because if it becomes an exercise in public relations, then you know it's not what you need to be doing. The truth was very important to me, and I went back and I talked to a lot of the people that I grew up with from Hebrew school, from college and high school, you know, and so much of what I remember never happened, you know. Or was an acid trip. And so it was so nice to be set straight. And my parents were very kind in that they allowed themselves to be interviewed for hours on end. And then I took them back to Russia for a very difficult trip back to Russia, where we uncovered many not nice things about our past. So it was grueling. That part of it was grueling because, you know, it really moving from from one failed superpower, the USSR, to whatever we are now, was difficult. But it's a very 20th century story. I mean, that's why I think I had to tell it, was I felt that, you know, it does have USSR and the USA, and that's what so much of that century was about. And I was lucky as a writer, in a way, to have been born into those circumstances, to grow up just to the, you know, being up to age 7 in Russia wasn't so bad as a kid because the Soviet Union was actually quite nice to children. It's once you had to enter school and join the Communist Youth League and all that nonsense that the problems really began. So I got sort of the best of it, and then I left, and then I got I got Hebrew school. So from Lenin to Reagan in 2 years.
Well, I know you all have a lot of questions. I believe that there are microphones that you can use in order to ask them. So if you want to put up a hand, and it looks like there are lovely humans who will bring a microphone to you.
Or any complaints. I get a lot of complaints, too. So.
Complaints?
You keep talking about a Hebrew school. I was a day school teacher, so is my friend here. What was the Hebrew school you went to? Did you by any chance go to the school that we taught at?
Which was the school? Let me find out which school it was, and then I can change it.
No. It was a Solomon Schechter school.
Yeah, in Queens.
No. Oh, well, no. You know, I lived in Queens, but I taught in Philadelphia.
A much better school. Everyone loves that school.
But I know the Solomon Schechter school in Queens.
There is one, yes. It's yes. Presently, yes.
That's where you went to school?
Oh, yes.
And you started in grade 1?
Grade 1 through 8. I did the whole schmear.
Okay.
It's interesting. Okay. I was doing a reading in Florida, and I met this young woman who had started at grade 2, and then her parents yanked her out of there, and she said, and sent her to a public school, and she said, that's where my life began, in a way.
Do you think it was good for you to go to a Hebrew school because you had to learn English? Here you were, a Russian.
Yeah.
Had to learn English and Hebrew.
Right.
Alphabets going two directions,
that's
plus
right.
Your very own mixed-up Russian alphabet.
Right.
So what did that do to you?
What did it do to me? It scared me from ever learning another language again. I've lived in Italy for a long time. All I learned are the gestures. A year and a half, this is all I can do. I lived in the Czech Republic, which has a Slavic language like Russian. Nothing. I had a professor who was drunk at 9 in the morning. He'd say, no class today, I am liquidated. No, it's useful. I do go to Israel a lot because my books are sold there. And there I meet you know, Russians who complain about living there as well. So it's a nice circle of complaints. The geschreiing is at a fever pitch when I arrive at Ben-Gurion Airport. It's, you know, in the end, everything is helpful to a writer. And having knowing the Old Testament is nice. You know, it was a good book. It was a number one bestseller for thousands of years, you know. Until Jennifer Weiner came along, that was what Jews read. Now, thankfully, we have her. It was positive and negative. It was mishugana. It was completely crazy. But I'm glad that it's changing, and I'm glad that now it's becoming more multicultural. Today, there was an article in the Times that was very interesting, the New York Times, about how a lot of these Hebrew schools are merging with a kind of Montessori method. And they talk about Solomon Schechter as one of the examples. They're trying to be more of a gateway to the world, you know, because when I was at Schechter, it was such a circumscribed world that I didn't even know what Manhattan was. I thought that the four skyscrapers on Queens Boulevard were Manhattan until I was like 13, you know. And when I moved to, when I went to Stuyvesant, which was in Manhattan, that was the best part of it was just meeting people who were different and just realizing that everyone, and it was a school that was about 70% Asian, and just realizing that the world wasn't Queens. So that was, there is something to be said for parochial school, but they have to be open to the world as well. And I think that's the movement that's been happening lately.
You've alluded to bad times in the FSU. Could you, was it anti-Semitism that caused your parents to want to leave? And were you part of the Refusenik community?
No.
And did you know about Sharansky? I mean, were you aware of what was going on there at the time?
Yeah, the question was I aware of what was happening in the growing up, was I aware what was happening in Russia and FSU, the former Soviet Union? Well, not really. I loved, as I said, I loved the Red Army. When I was 5 years old, I wrote a book, my first novel, called Lenin and His Magical Goose, that my grandmother, who was an editor for Evening Leningrad, a newspaper, and a staunch communist, had commissioned. She paid me a piece of cheese for every page I wrote, and it was a 100 pages long, and it was about Lenin meeting this magical goose, invading Finland, and fomenting a socialist revolution there. And then the goose is Menshevik. Lenin eats the goose out of political considerations. I remember my grandmother saying, you know, maybe he doesn't eat the goose. Maybe he exiles the goose to Mexico. ice pick. So growing up, obviously, I had no idea about anti-Semitism. It wasn't, you know, a part of growing up. My parents did. My father would march in front of the synagogue, and he was very expressive about that. He cared more about that. In fact, when I went to Hebrew school and I told him that I was having such a difficult time, it didn't register because, for him, the difficult time comes from outside of your community. It's the idea that Jews can not be friends to other Jews was absolutely shocking. Did he know Refuseniks? I think he probably did. We certainly weren't Refuseniks. We were given exit visas almost immediately. Remember, this was 1979. This was the era of the grain Jews. This is where Jimmy Carter and Leonid Brezhnev had reached a deal in which millions, the Russian grain harvest was poor, as it is often very poor, and millions of tons of grain were exchanged for 50,000 Soviet Jews. So I was essentially sent, traded for 30 pieces of bread and a baguette. And Jackson Vanek was the amendment that was passed. So yes, and high technology. The Soviet Union had these exploding television sets, and technology was granted as well. So the difference was one in generation. You know, to my parents, obviously getting out of Russia meant, or for my father at least. My mother was not that keen on being Jewish, but for my father, it meant asserting a Jewish identity. But growing up, I didn't know what a Jew was. I mean, all I wanted was to be a good Russian communist, you know. So I remember that in Rome, the first stop in moving between these places, first was Vienna, then came Rome, and I would always play with these clothing pins that I pretended were airplanes, and one was a Boeing, an American plane, and another was the Tupolev, the Soviet plane. And I would always have the Tupolev win, and my father sat me down and said, from now on, the Boeing has to win. And I was, you know, incredibly hurt, and it was a kind of betrayal, it felt like. But the need to connect with something was so strong that in America, of course, we became staunch Republicans, as so many Soviet Jews did. And I believed as fervently in the National Review, which I would subscribe to, with its Margaret Thatcher on the cover, on every cover, you know. I believed in that as fervently as I once believed in whatever the newspaper would say in Russia. So it was a nation of dissidents, but when we came here, we became true believers in a way.
So what's next?
A cheesesteak. Yes, definitely with. While sailing across both rivers. What's next? Well, you know, in this book, after you read this book, there's nothing about me you won't know, for better or worse. The first interview I had was with the wonderful writer Francine Prose for Interview Magazine. She said, geez, after reading this, I know more about you than I know about my husband of 20 years. You know? So this book kind of does give away the store completely. There's no more Russian nebbish shtick that I can use anymore. It's all gone. So I'll have to write about, you know, non-male Russian Jews. I'll have to write about Gentile women. So first I'll have to meet them. I've already put out a Facebook ad, and I got a response, like a big response, you know. So I am going to learn what makes these people tick, and I am going to write a novel from their point of view. Philip Roth did this after he did Goodbye Columbus, right? And the Jewish community went bananas. Did I do something wrong? Sorry.
It says there's some Gentile women in the
Gentile
audience.
Gentile women in the audience. Right. Oh, good Lord. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize this was going to happen. this happened in my room in North Dakota as well. That's where they live. So, you know, after Goodbye Columbus, the Jewish community, the rabbis came on stage and said, you know, one of them said memorably, medieval Jews would know what to do with a man like that. So Roth was scared, not just scared, but ashamed of what he had done in a way. And then he wrote these books set in the Midwest, Gentile women narrators, When She Was Good, Losing Her. Look, he's an amazing writer. He can't write a bad book, but these were not books that we remember him for. And then he came back, and the next book he wrote was Portnoy's, which, of course, we remember quite well. So there could be a lesson in this, that the next book I write can be a disaster from which I will come back. But right now, I want to spread my wings a little and write about something else. Also, I want to write a kind of a book set in many cities. I do a lot of travel writing for Travel and Leisure magazine. So I want to write a book set in Shanghai and Dubai and Mumbai and all the I cities that are out there. So
for further questions, if you could raise your hand, I will call upon you. Looks like there's someone way in the back.
Is there such a thing as a dystopian novel of the future, or is that the only novel of the future that we can write?
Well, there's definitely no utopian novel left. That went out a while ago. I was just being interviewed with Cheng Rae Lee, who was my mentor, the wonderful Korean-American writer, who apparently is coming here on March 13th. So with Laurie Moore, please do see him. He's fantastic. He was my mentor, and he got me my first book published. And we were being interviewed by New York Magazine after a series of drinks, which loosened my tongue to the point where I made fun of Canadian fiction. The next day, I wake up, the National Post, the Globe and Mail, every Canadian newspaper is baying for my blood. Which is cute, because Canadians still care about literature, apparently. So the utopian novel will definitely be Canadian, but we definitely own the dystopian one. But Cheng Rae was saying in that interview, because he had just written a dystopian novel, Anna Fulci, and I had written Super Sad True Love Story, and the interviewer said, geez, you immigrants, you know, what's up with your dystopian fiction? And he said that basically every immigrant novel, in a sense, is a dystopian novel because it's about coming to a, much as, you know, in science fiction, there's always this kind of interspecies, interplanetary voyage that doesn't end well. So it's the case for literary fiction, which isn't to say that all immigrant stories don't end well, but if you come here and you assimilate and you're happy, then you're not going to write a book about it. You're just going to be happy that your hedge fund is doing really well and and buy the nicest place in Rittenhouse Square you can imagine. But for the rest of us, there's fiction.
Yeah. Or that you're either in psychoanalysis or you were in psychoanalysis. And I, as a former analysand, I was wondering how that affected your writing or how it's affected your writing. Right.
Thank you. Well, look, I'm not one of those crazy Woody Allen-esque New Yorkers that goes five times a week. I only go four times. And it's only been 12 years, so it's I'm fine. Obviously, I'm fine. Shame on you for suggesting otherwise. It's been great. No, it's been wonderful, and it's been especially good for this memoir because I think that every single thing that's been said over the years is in here in one way or another. In a way, I see analysis as kind of publishing things into the air, floating them out as trial balloons. And, you know, in traditional analysis, the analyst rarely says anything. So you're the one who's saying things first. So what I do now is I take down notes while I'm talking in analysis, because often that's, you know, that's the safe space where you can say these things, and saying them aloud is very helpful. So, look, analysis has fallen into a lot of disfavor because we're in the era of managed care where, you know, just pile on those Xanax and have a good day. And there's nothing wrong with that. But psychoanalysis requires, it's very similar to writing a book. It's the process of digging and digging like a little terrier, you know, until you find, but instead of finding yummy things like your terrier, you find crap that you then have to make art out of. So it's not good. Boy, that was a labored analogy. Woof.
You talked a little bit in your book about the cost of therapy and how you were joking about how that's what you would think about. So I was wondering if, A, like, you know, how you got past that. I mean, and B, did you start in analysis, or did you start going just, you know, occasionally and get more into it? Just kind of, you know, a little more about your therapy.
Well, problems of this magnitude are not dealt with in single therapy sessions. cognitive behavior therapy, which is all the mode now, can help somebody who has problems with smoking or nail biting or ingrown toenail phobia. This, as you will read from the book if you buy it, requires a whole teardown and a rebuilding of, you know, of the personality. So there was no question that it had to be done, that this was a major, you know, effort. The earlier part, payment, yes. I don't like to spend money. But it does, and when I started, my analyst was just finishing up at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, so he was only charging $15 a session. But for me, that seemed like a fortune. I wasn't earning much money, but still, you know, it was $60 a week. And I think it was in a reflection of the fact that I grew up very poor, and that my parents, even when my parents started making money, they were so scared of losing their jobs because of their bad English or, you know, just scared of us being out on the street, that they were very careful with the money. And I was, didn't, you know, for a while I only had one shirt and then two shirts. And then, you know, it was, money was something I was very concerned about. And in all my books, there's narrators who are scared about losing money. And even in my nightmares, I still dream in Russian and I have, you know, I count money coming out of an ATM, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 in Russian, which was one of the first things we talked about in psychoanalysis. So, it was kind of a breakthrough when I felt that he wasn't cheating me with his $15 an hour session, you know. Paying double minimum wage was not his way of, you know, screwing me over. Because that's what I thought, and I would be very angry. So you're taking advantage of me. So, yeah. But now I pay a lot more.
When you were a kid, there was an emergency situation with your asthma. And then that had to do with your parents' decision for leaving and coming to America. And then it wasn't an emergency. You just took this little pill called a steroid. And I was wondering, when you realized the weight of that decision.
Almost immediately. In the Soviet Union, they didn't have steroid inhalers for asthma. So whenever I had an asthma attack, the doctor either had to come to the house or an ambulance took me to, you know, there was no, it was terrible asthma. Leningrad is also built on a swamp, not great for asthma. In fact, we were considering moving to Arizona because of its dry climate. Several Russians with asthma ended up there on that pretext and are now in deep, deep psychological pain. so, you know. But what happened was that upon landing, Vienna was our first stop, and so we land in Vienna, and of course I have an asthma attack right there.
And the doctor, we go see an Austrian doctor. And in Russia, one of the remedies for asthma was cupping. Cupping exists in China as well. You take a glass cylinder, curved glass cylinder, you put a flame in there so that taking out the air, the oxygen, and creating suction, you plop it on the patient's back so it sticks. And you arrange about 10 of these cylinders across. You imagine you're a child and you're watching basically internal combustion taking place on your back. The other great thing about cupping is that it's completely useless. It has absolutely no effect. So the child lies there looking like a stegosaurus for a while. Then they're painfully removed. So when we got to the doctor in Vienna, he wanted to call child services. He thought, you know, because my back was just this bruised monstrosity. And my parents said, no, we use cupping. And he said, oh, you crazy Russians. You know? That was great, you know, when the Mongols were in charge of Hungary in 1500 BC, but, you know, we really don't do that anymore in the West. We use an inhaler. So I used the inhaler, and I just stopped being unable to breathe. And talk about a metaphor. You know, you leave the East, you leave the Soviet Union for the Western world, and the first day you land, you're able to breathe. It's incredible.
With all the writing that you do in the magazines and the blurbs and the travel writing and all of that, how do you have the time and what's the process for actually putting together a work of fiction or a memoir?
Well, most of what I write is outsourced to India these days. you know, there are mistakes that slip in. This guy Rajiv in Bangalore does most of my books. So you're looking at page 251 and, you know, my mother woke up. It was an overcast Leningrad morning. She put on her best sari and began to make the rice and dal. I mean, so that slipped through, obviously. There's a lot of mistakes like that. But Rajiv is good. You know, he knows what he's doing. I pay him 700 rupees a book, which is $12. So outsourcing, no. It's hard. Look, it's hard. In the olden days, when you wrote a book that and people liked the book and reviewed the book, and every newspaper, every tiny newspaper in America had a book section, the word just got out. If you got on the front page of the New York Times or whatever, or got on a Kakutani Review, people bought a million copies right there. Now that doesn't happen anymore. The amount of time that I spend to promote a book is about a year. It's about 365 days of touring in America, touring abroad where the book comes out, making trailers, making out with James Franco, whatever it takes. So if it takes 2 years to write a book, it takes about a year to promote it. So that has changed the way, and people say, oh my God, writers are so lazy these days, they come out with a book every 4 or 5 years instead of every 2 or 3 years. But that's been the economics of it, is that the decline in readership, the decline in getting the word out through things like standalone book sections. Nowadays, I think only the New York Times has a standalone book section. I think the LA Times and the Post, the Washington Post, are now folded into an entertainment section, right? They're not standalone sections. But remember, back in the day, every damn newspaper had their own section. Probably the Philly Inquirer did too, right? It did, right? Of course, of course. So that has changed things around. Why, you know, look, I love learning about the different rivers on Twitter, but the reason I'm on it all the time is promotional. You know, you get people to come to readings, buy books, etc. It's a completely different environment for writers. Older writers have a lot of problems with this. It's very hard for them to get into this whole endless touring. And also, it's very hard to just be on the road. You know, this tour for English-speaking countries, US, UK, Canada, Australia, is 149 days of just being on the road, you know, begging people in Akron, Ohio to try reading something, you know. So it takes a toll. And I'm one of the lucky ones, and you are with your next book too, who actually still have book tours, because for many other people, there's no book tour, and then there's no promotion in you know, the standalone book sections that used to exist. So the books just disappear. Publishing often takes an attitude that they'll throw a bunch of stuff at a wall, maybe through word of mouth something will stick, but the rest of them will sell, you know, 1,000, 2,000 copies and go away. And that's too bad, because a lot of those books are amazing. The readership, the quality of books out there is, this is a wonderful time. The problem is a supply and demand thing. The more wonderful writers there are, the fewer readers there are in America. There's now 860,000 writers in America because we love self-expression so much, but there's only 83,000 readers, of whom you form 300 or so. So that's the imbalance, and that's why it's so hard to connect readers and writers, and that's why in making trailers and stuff like that, I'm actually saying, hey, just try this art form again. You might be surprised.
We're going to have time for one more question. Gary's wonderful memoir is for sale here, and I'm sure he'd be happy to sign your Kindle or the back of your iPad or the front of it. So we have one last question over here.
What is your take on Pussy Riot? What does that tell us about Russia?
Thank you for that final question. I don't enjoy the music of Pussy Riot as much as I enjoy the Goldberg variations. Although the two of them together, the Pussy variations would be wonderful. Glenn Riot would be a wonderful way of playing it together. Yes. Well, I love Putin. He's the world's best kleptocrat. Nobody can steal as fast as he can. And that's a Guinness World Record right there. $50 billion for Sochi. Yeah, $42 billion more than for Vancouver. Somebody made out pretty good. And what are they going to do with it? Probably they're going to start a Jewish literary magazine, right? That's all the rage, right, in Moscow? I'm glad that there is an opposition in Russia. The question is, to what extent will it matter? Pussy Riot, Khodorkovsky, the jailed oil billionaire who was recently released. There's an opposition, but it's very much focused in Moscow and people who have Twitter accounts, maybe a little bit in Petersburg and some other towns. The masses in Russia are pro-Putin for now. The opposition isn't as great as one thinks. Even if there wasn't fraud in the election, and there are fraud, he would still probably win. He would most likely win an election. Because people like sausages in Russia very much. And since Putin has come to power, there have been more sausages. Quite a lot of sausages have appeared in stores. But remember that the sausages are tied to oil production and gas production, because that's all Russia produces for the most part. It's not a country, you know, there's no Google, there's no Apple. For that. For Google, you need people like Sergey Brin, who left Russia and moved to Palo Alto, where they can actually do stuff, or Mountain View, or whatever the Californian burg is. That's the beauty of writing about Russia, is that it never changes. It's always a disaster. There's a restaurant called 1913 in Petersburg, and I asked the owner, why 1913? And she said, well, it's the only good year in Russian history. And that's a shame for the 145 million people that have to live in Russia. But for satirists, it's a gold mine. So we are thankful for Putin and Pussy Riot for that.
And thankful for you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.